Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Chapter 10 is one of the most exciting chapters because it deals with the futility and foolishness and the delusion of idolatry. Verses 1 through 16, I guess, form one of the strongest statements in all the Old Testament on the ridiculousness of man worshiping things that he makes with his own hands. And because of that, this chapter has been very influential. Since we're going to be depicting the vanity or the nothingness of idols, it's obvious this chapter is going to be very important on the uniqueness of God, the power of God, the kingship of God. So we're going to say tremendous statements about the Lord here because it's comparing him to these idols. And so it's a very important chapter for much Jewish theology about who God is. And then in the final closing verses here, 17 and following, again we come back to this same theme that's been all the way through Jeremiah of the exile is coming and you're going to be taken out of the land. So let's look, if we could, I hope you'll open your Bibles to Jeremiah chapter 10. On your outline, words number one, the word here. The reason I didn't fill it in, I wrote this at camp. I didn't have my Hebrew Bible with me. I thought that was the word Shema, but I wasn't sure. I needed to get back and look, and sure enough, it was. It is the same word that is used in the high prayer of Judaism for the uniqueness of God, the oneness of God. We call it the Shema, and that's what this verb is. That's where it comes from. And it's in Deuteronomy 6, verse 3. It means, when I say the word hear to you in English, you think of the process of listening. But for Judaism, when I say the word hear, and they would understand Shema to be behind that, they would understand not just the act of hearing, but the act of hearing resulting in the action of doing or obeying that which you hear. So it is a hear and do. Now, that's a very important biblical concept. I think all too often we want to know more and more and more about the Bible, about theology, about God. We're always seeking for more about His will for our lives and on and on. I want to tell you, God's not going to reveal more about Himself to you and about His plan for your life until you act on what you already know. Now, the problem is we don't need to know more about God and more about His will for our lives. We need to implement what we already know to be His will. And I think that's very important. So here's the idea. Hear and do. I'm going to change the translation some. Hear and do the word which the Lord speaks to you, O house of Israel. Again, it's not Jeremiah's word. And it's going to be a whole big discussion about the wise men of the other nations just do what they think in their own heart. But Israel follows the dictates of God. The prophets just don't have a dream some night and say, this is what God said. But God speaks to them in a way that they know it's Him, and it is a contented message. Now, the little phrase, the house of Israel, we need to stop for a moment, because depending on what part of the Bible you're in and what context you're in, this means several different things. If we're talking about Israel back in Genesis, and we're talking about the 12 tribes of Jacob, then the house of Israel would simply refer to that large group of people that went down into Egypt because of the famine in Palestine. It simply mean Jacob and his kids. Now, as you know, Jacob's name was changed as he wrestled with the angel at the brook Jabbok just before he went back to meet his brother going back into the promised land. And so it became the house of Israel. Israel is the new name for Jacob. Now, it's also used in 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, as a name for the entire nation, O Israel. And it would speak of all the tribes and all the promised land. But later we get into the monarchical period after the split between Jeroboam and Rehoboam, Solomon's son, an Ephraimic labor leader. And then the house of Israel does not include the 12 tribes anymore, but just the 10 northern tribes that we call by two other names. And wherever these names appear in the right section as far as the monarchy being split, it means the northern 10 tribes. They're called Israel, they're called Ephraim, and they're called Samaria. And all of those titles are for the northern 10 tribes. Now, for the book of Jeremiah, the house of Israel used to the northern 10 tribes is a little problematical because we don't know when Jeremiah wrote this. But surely the northern 10 tribes are gone into captivity by the time this book was written. Jeremiah lived at the end of the southern kingdom around 586 when Nebuchadnezzar ultimately destroyed and took them captivity. But the northern 10 tribes have been gone now a long, long time. They were taken captive in 722 B.C. by Assyria. And so the house of Israel cannot mean what it normally means. All of Israel can't mean that. Northern 10 tribes can't mean that. So it's probably speaking of all the Jewish people who were left. The few stragglers from the north and the people of the south. Okay? Then in verse 2, "Thus says the Lord, do not learn the way of the nations. Do not be terrified by the signs of the heavens, although the nations are terrified by them." I want to pick up, first of all, a little phrase. Do not learn the way of the nations. Now, this is the word, it's the idea of ancient paths. You might want to see Leviticus 18:3, where it's mentioned. It's saying, it's not talking about a road map. It's talking about don't learn and implement the lifestyle of the nations that do not know God. Don't do the things they do. Don't pray their prayers. Don't worship their gods. Don't do their rituals. Don't practice their religion. That's what it's talking about. When Jesus in the New Testament, John 14:6, says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." Two of the words he uses for himself, the way and the truth, are used in their Old Testament sense in this chapter. When Jesus says, "I am the way," he is making allusion to the ancient way that God's people were to live. He's saying, "I am the way," not that he's a road or a path so much. He is the embodiment of the lifestyle of the people of God as they walk in God's will. That's what it means. The early church was known as the way. And that's where it comes from, these Old Testament passages about lifestyle. Now, where it mentions here, terrified by the signs of heaven, one of your discussion questions is, are we dealing with Babylonian gods or Canaanite gods? And boy, I don't know, because there seems to be an allusion to both. Astral worship, or the worship of the heavenly bodies, or planets, stars, moon, sun, all that, was started in Babylon. And the Old Testament rails against that. Deuteronomy 17, 2 through 5 says, "If someone worships the host of heaven, they will be taken outside the city and stoned." Deuteronomy 18, verses 11, 10 and 11, lists for us all the things that are abomination to God. And in there is divination or astrology, or trying to tell the future by the stars. You know, it amazes me that people, you know, we think we're so sophisticated. We have such scientific technology and wonderful kinds of things like that. And I want to tell you, the culture that's so steeped in scientific technology is a culture that buys horoscopes off the stands of every grocery store and reads in the newspaper the most ridiculous system of predicting the future that's ever been come onto man. And that is a false view even of the origin or the paths of the planets. Now, we claim to be so smart and we're sucked in by some stupid thing like that that we never check the history on amazes me. People are gullible. We are looking for anything in the world to find the future. Do you know it? Astrology is one way the heathen tried to know the future without going through God. And it's railed against. A passage in Isaiah 47:13 is interesting. About Isaiah says, "You've trusted in the astrologers. Now let's see if they can help you." And of course they couldn't. So here it's Babylonian astral worship, I think, that's being condemned. Many people, because this is mentioned so often in the book of Isaiah, think that this is not Jeremiah's, but it's Isaiah's. You know, if you buy the presupposition that the Bible is not written by the authors, if you think it's done by a whole bunch of different people at different times and stuck together and all that, you can get anything. You know, I just have a naive understanding of the fact that when God says to Jeremiah that maybe there's an editor involved in putting Jeremiah's stuff together, I don't discard that. But I don't think Isaiah wrote a chunk out of Jeremiah. And the Bible just said Jeremiah said it when he didn't. But what it's saying is there is a common cultural, proverbial, Jewish understanding about astral deities. It's embodied in Jeremiah. It's embodied in Isaiah. Let me give you some of the verses. I don't think I put them on your list. There was no place to put them. Let me list you some of the places in Isaiah. The same theme is talked about idols and all of that. Isaiah 2:20, Isaiah 31:7, Isaiah 40:18 and through 20, Isaiah 41:7, Isaiah 44:9 through 20, and Isaiah 46:5 through 7. Well, you can tell it's a pretty common theme. Isaiah has been jumping up and down about idolatry, and so has Jeremiah, and they're very close together. Now, I want to read part of this because I think it's so beautifully done that reading it communicates exactly what it's trying to say. Let me begin in verse 3. Okay. By the way, these signs in the heavens are either comets, eclipses, strange alignments of stars, and that kind of stuff terrified people in ancient times. And we are not to be bothered by that. You see, they believe that nature controls them. We believe that God controls nature. And if it rains, we don't fall down and pray. We get out of the rain. For the custom of the peoples are a delusion. Now, there's a word that's going to be used again over here in about verse... I can't see it right now, but it's in there. It's a word that is usually translated in Ecclesiastes, vanity, nothingness, mist. It means non-entity. What it's saying is, idols are just nothing. There's nothing behind idols. Now, in the New Testament, Paul will say that the demons are behind idols. That's not a contradiction. Jeremiah says there's nothing real there. Paul says the evil one has used the nothingness to trick men. Okay? Now, because it is wood cut from a forest, the work of the hands of the craftsman with a cutting tool, they decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it with nails and with hammers so it will not totter. And look at verse 5. If you have King James, it says, it stands upright like a palm tree. Let me read New American Standard. I thought it was classic. Like a scarecrow in a cucumber field are they. The Jews ate lots of vegetables. It mentioned over and over. Cucumbers, I don't know if Peggy was here, she would want to know if they're burpless or not. But there's no way to know about these ancient vegetables. We're not even sure exactly what the names are. They had leeks and those kind of things, and they ate them a lot because they didn't eat much meat. Now, a scarecrow in a cucumber field. How is an idol like that? Well, you stick it up there. It doesn't say anything. But it's just being there scares the birds and stuff. You got to pick it up and carry it if you want to move. It can't speak to you. It can't do anything. It's just there. It's exactly what the work of man's hands when they worship it. I don't care how fancy it is. I don't care how much gold you put on it. I don't care anything. I got a card today from the Pickerings, and they're on vacation, and they must be somewhere in the Orient, because they sent me the picture of a great big golden Buddha. And she said there, you can't imagine the number of people bowing down, worshiping this thing and placing food before it. Now, somebody carved that stinking thing out of a rock. Now, the difference between idols and God is, idols can't hear, speak, move, or do anything. But God can do everything for His people. Okay, like a scarecrow, here it says, they can't speak, they must be carried about because they cannot walk. Do not fear them. They cannot harm you, nor can they do any good. He's saying they ain't negative and they ain't positive. They just nothing. Nothing. Now look at verse 6. Here's the affirmation of who God is. There is none like thee, O Lord. Thou art great, and great is thy name in might. Now, when it says there is none like thee, that is a Jewish way of saying that there is nothing in the category with God, that God is unique, one of a kind. This is getting very, very close, if not right on target, with philosophical monotheism. Now, I've talked to you a lot about practical monotheism. For Israel in Deuteronomy, there was only one God for them, although Moses talked about the gods of the nations. By the 8th century prophets, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Ezekiel, they just say there are no other gods. There is only one God, and that's monotheism. Okay? Now, this is much like Deuteronomy 5:7. That's one of the Ten Commandments. There is no other God beside me. That's the way it's usually translated in English. What that means is, in Hebrew the word means, there is nothing in front of me, there is nothing behind me, there is nothing on either side of me, there is nothing on par with me, I am in a category all by myself. I think the little Latin phrase, sui genus, or what does it mean? It means unique. Isn't that it? Something like that? No Latin scholars here, I see. Including me. It's funny, but the Septuagint omits verses 6 through 8 and verse 10. And the reason it puts verse 9 after verse 5. Now, why? I have no idea. You know, we really have a problem with some of these manuscripts. People who pick up an English Bible and just whistle down the road never realize the struggle people go to try to get the actual words of the Old Testament. Did you know until the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in 1947 that the oldest copy, I mean the very, very oldest copy of the Old Testament was 9th century A.D.? And only after we found the Dead Sea Scrolls did we realize that the manuscripts that we had from the 9th century A.D., the Masoretic scholars, were at least several years B.C. But you know, there's several different... The Septuagint, the reason I keep mentioning that, the reason it's so important is, if the oldest Hebrew manuscript that we have is 9 A.D., or 9 in the 800s after Christ... The Septuagint, we know from history, was translated from Hebrew manuscripts around 200 to 250 B.C. And therefore, what we have is Jewish scholars interpreting or translating the text that they had before them into another language. Now, why this is missing, we have no earthly idea. It's really a problem. I don't know. I still like the Masoretic text, which is the 8th century one. The Dead Sea Scrolls proved it to be very accurate. And the Septuagint changes a whole lot. It takes out repetitious phrases because it thinks they're boring, and it changes interpretation. So I trust the one you have before you, even though the other one is very interesting to look at. Let me just mention to you. That is available for you in an English translation at any bookstore by Zondervan Publishers. Have you ever thought about buying the Septuagint to read with your Old Testament? What you get is an ancient interpretation by Jews of their own scripture before the fight over who is Jesus began. It's available. It's a cute little blue. Go real well with your eyes. Notice where it mentions verse 7. Who would not fear thee, O King of the nations? Indeed, it is thy due. Now, here is something very interesting. The Bible doesn't talk a lot about God as the King of Israel, though that is an assumption made from the very first. Remember when Israel wanted a king and God told Samuel, said, no. And God told Samuel, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. They want a king, and I'm their king, but they're rejecting me. So God as King of Israel is a pretty common Old Testament theme. But God as King of the nations is an absolutely startling statement, especially to Jewish people. Now, to a bunch of Jews who were claiming how much God loved them, Jeremiah saying God is the King of the nations, really, now that upset them, you see. Here is one of the universal elements of the Old Testament. Isaiah has the most full-blown universality, that God is the God of all people. But now think with me for a minute. If there really is only one God, there's no other gods but one. And the Jews know that God, when He created, said it's good and it's very good, including all of creation, because all man come from one racial stock, Adam. Then there's got to be God loving all people. Now Israel may be the firstborn in the sense of giving revelation to the rest. But God is a God of the world. He loves man because he created him. And that's what the affirmation here is. I think it's very important, this universal element. For among all the wise men of the nations and in all their kingdoms, there is none like thee. Uniqueness of God. Verse 8. But they are altogether stupid and foolish in their discipline and their vanity. There's that word. Verse 8. Nothingness. Their idol is wood. Boy, that is an extremely difficult phrase. That thing in Hebrew is a mess. And if you have different translations here, if you look at your neighbor, you'll see how widely that thing differs. This is what I think what it's saying is obvious, but I think exactly the words we can't even get close to. It's saying, Jeremiah, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah. Jeremiah heard it some way or intuitively heard it, and I don't know if it was audible or intuitive. But anyway, Jeremiah got the word of the Lord, and Jeremiah gave the word of the Lord to the people. Now he's saying, the wise men of the nations, though God is their king, the one God, the unique God, though he is the God of all the nations, the wise men of the nations listen and hear themselves and then speak for a non-entity in stupidity. As Jeremiah hears God and gives it, these wise men of the nations play like they're listening and spout something out, but it's stupidity. You see what it's saying? Now that's the Hebrews communicating that, though it's very, very difficult, okay? Isn't this cute? I wrote this down. Possibly their wise men get their knowledge from a dead stump. That's the idol. Now, when you get your knowledge from a dead stump, you're in trouble, you know, because that means if you have a bad cucumber, your theology changes. Verse 9. Beaten silver is brought from Tarshish. Now, where else in the Bible have you heard Tarshish? What other Bible story y'all be familiar with from child? Jonah. That's where Jonah was heading for. Tarshish. Now, we don't know where in the world that is. It is the proverbial other side of the world. We would say, boy, it's in China. They would say it's in Tarshish. That is the... Let me think which way I'm going. It's this way. That is the farthest western point that they knew in their day. That's east, isn't it? Wherever you want Tarshish to be, it can be. We think it may be Spain, but we're not sure. So Tarshish, it's mentioned in Ezekiel 27:12. It's probably Spain, but we're not be sure. And the next little phrase says, gold from Euphaz. Now, we don't know what Euphaz is for nothing. It's a place name, seems like. Now, the Septuagint, the Peshitta and the Targums. Now, the Peshitta is a Syriac translation, Aramaic translation. The Targums are Aramaic translations on Hebrew scriptures. They say it's the name Ophir. Now, that is a place name. We know where that is. O-P-H-I-R. That's a locality. But this Hebrew word is used in 1 Kings 10:18 to be refined or purified gold. So instead of it being a place name, it may mean they get syrup from Tarshish and they bring pure, refined gold. So it may not be a place name at all. And we just can't be sure. The work of craftsmen and of the hands of the goldsmith. Violet and purple are their clothing. Now remember, in Jesus' day, purple and violet were the royal colors of kings and Roman officials and all that. Why? Purple dye was very, very, very expensive. It came from the shell of a certain mollusk, a saltwater animal. The Phoenicians discovered the purple dye, and it's mentioned in historical text by 2000 B.C. Man, they had purple socks long before they had anything else. So purple is a very expensive color. And, of course, they'd put the most expensive thing on their idols. It's like dressing up your Barbie doll, you know, the best you can, and then worshiping it. They are all the work of skilled men. All right. But the Lord is the true God. Now, notice on verse number 11 under your word study, I've left it blank because I wasn't sure this was a Hebrew word I'm thinking of, but it really is. This is the word that I don't think it's a good translation at all. I think it's pretty bad. Does anybody have another translation? The Lord is the true God. Does somebody have something else? Living Bible or anything, does anything have the Lord is the faithful one, the Lord is the dependable one, something like that? This is not saying that God is the embodiment of absolute philosophical truth. This is not saying that God is the ideal and everything else the pale shadow. This is not saying that God is the encyclopedia of real knowledge and everything else is a false delusion. This is saying that as the idols do not help you when you pray to them. They can't walk, they can't see, they can't talk. You've got to nail them to the floor to keep them from falling over. With that kind of ridiculousness, if you pray to them, nothing happens. If you pray to God, He is faithful and dependable in His relations with men that He acts. That's the truth here. God is a God that acts dependable, trustworthy, faithfully to what He has said and promised. Now that's what the thing means. And so I would retranslate, Yahweh is faithful and dependable when called upon. Something like that. Now, this is the other word that I told you that Jesus used Himself. I am the way, the truth, and the life. We've already talked about the word path is used here, or way. This is the word truth. I do not think Jesus was saying, I am the embodiment of truth in the philosophical sense. He was saying, I embody the way of God. I also embody faithfulness, dependability. Isn't that what Hebrews 13:8 is trying to say? Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. God's dependability is what it's talking about. He is the living God, the everlasting King. Now, the word living God is something that we very often don't realize, but that really is the one adjective that describes God. The word Yahweh, the covenant name for God, YHWH, the Hebrew verb to be, okay, is a way of talking about that God is an ever-living God. When it says, as I live, says the Lord, God is swearing by His own life. That's the strongest thing He can swear by. He is the ever-existing one, and everything else only exists in relation to Him. So when it says the living God, that is the strongest Hebrew way of describing God. Now it says the everlasting King, same idea. He isn't king by election, He's king by who He is, period. And He's king of the world. At His wrath, the earth quakes. The same book that tells about God is love, and that God is dependable, and that God is forgiving, and that God is accepting, is the very same revelation that tells us that God's dependability, God's love, God's acceptance, and God's forgiveness spurned becomes God's reaction, which is God's wrath. So, you know, this that God is love is wonderful, but you got to balance that with the fact that love spurned becomes negative. Verse 11, if you can believe this, look at your translation. Does your translation say anything to you about verse 11? Anything in the margin, anything, Max? If you were reading a book and you were reading along in English, you've been reading now for several chapters, and you suddenly came and one verse out of the whole book was in Spanish, what would you think? I mean, it's one verse in the whole book of Jeremiah is in Aramaic. It's different as night and day, but it's different from Hebrew. You could be reading along, it just blow your gourd. It's just like right in another language. That's what it's doing. Well, people have really said, how do you explain this? It seems to fit in the context. Modern scholars say it's an addition, but it does fit in the context. It doesn't break into the context. Why would Jeremiah do that? Nobody knows, but here's some theories. The rabbis say this was a copy of a letter written to King Jehoiachin in exile in Babylon to encourage him not to worship idols. Another guy I read said, this is an exorcism phrase, and you have to quote it in the original for it to work. Guess what? We don't know why it's in here. Jeremiah, I don't know what he did, but he did a number on us here, I want to tell you. One verse is all there is. Here it is. Thus you shall say to them, The gods that did not make the heavens and the earth shall perish from the earth and from under the heavens. That's it. And right back into Hebrew. I don't know. I just don't know. I think it's a very positive statement, but I don't know why it's there. Verse 12. It is He who made the earth by His power, who established the world by His wisdom. Here is the affirmation. There is one Creator, and everything else is created. Okay? This idea about His wisdom. Have you ever read Proverbs 8, 22 through 31? I personally believe that when the Apostle John was writing the prologue to John's Gospel, which is, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. I think John was pulling from the Hebrew concept, not the Greek concept, but the Hebrew concept of wisdom found in Proverbs 8, 22 through 31. That says the first creation of God was wisdom. And through wisdom, God created the earth. And I'm not saying Jesus created, but I am saying the preeminence of the concept of wisdom in the Old Testament. And here it is again. Who established the world by His wisdom is consistent with the theology of Proverbs 8, 22 through 31. Now, verses 12 through 16 are repeated verbatim in Jeremiah 51, 15 through 19. Verbatim, word for word, dot for dot. Now, that tells me that we're having what we got. It's kind of like Jeremiah preached a sermon and he wrote it out and he stuck it in a drawer. And he preached another one and he stuck it in a drawer. And he preached another one and he stuck it in a drawer. And somewhere down the line, either Jeremiah went back and put his sermons together by topic, or some Baruch or somebody he knew went back and put them in by topic. Because when you got two verbatim things in the same book, you're drawing from another source, whether it be yourself or something else. It's got to be a written source, because you wouldn't get jot for jot and tittle for tittle, you know, probably. The Jews probably could do that with their emphasis on memory, but boy, I sure couldn't. Verse 13. Then He utters His voice, there is a tumult of waters. That's a verse used in Revelation over and over. The tumult of waters, the rush of waters, speaking about God's voice here. When He spoke, man, things began to shake. All right? And here's a description of the rain clouds. Now, you wonder why. Let me just ask you a question. Why would Jeremiah put a detailed description of the process of rain in a chapter dealing with idolatry? Fertility worship, Baal. They were saying Baal gives the rain. Jeremiah says Baal doesn't give the rain. Yahweh gives the rain. So here is a Canaanite god. The astral deities were Babylonian. But these are Canaanite fertility religion. It's saying Baal didn't do this. God did. Here's the description. He causes the clouds to ascend from the ends of the earth. Now, what is that? You know, people really get uptight with it. We try to make the Bible a scientific book. The Bible so predates Western science that there is no way to equate them. The Bible is not a scientific book. The Bible is a book in the language of description. It describes the laws of nature by the way they seem. Where do the clouds come from? Scientifically, what is it? It's water molecules cool to a certain density and they begin to collect and get thicker and they form clouds. When Elijah was up on Mount Carmel and he prayed for God to send rain, what came out of the sea? Clouds. They came from the horizon and they were little, and the closer they came, the bigger they got. Where do clouds come from? They come from the ends of the earth. They come from the horizon. Isn't that where you see a thunderstorm come from? You look over in that part of the west or the east or whatever it is, and it gets dark on the horizon. It gets dark, it gets dark, it gets dark, and pretty soon it's woof. That's what it's saying. It's the language of description that clouds come from the west or the east. And here, what's on the west that make Jeremiah say they come that way? Mediterranean. That's the way the winds go. The rains come this way, you know, the desert. As the clouds rise in the west, God causes it. That's not a scientific description. It's a theological statement. God is behind the forces of nature. God sends the rain. That's what it's talking about. The next little phrase, He makes lightning for the rain, for the downpour. Okay? Brings out the wind from its storehouse. Now, the wind in a storehouse is not saying, ah, the Bible's wrong. See, wind's not a storehouse. Obviously, the Bible's wrong. Ha, ha, ha. It's an ancient metaphor to describe God and control of nature. It never meant to be taken as a meteorological description of the place God keeps the wind. Mercy sakes. Okay. The word breath there in verse 14, very important. That's a very theological term. It's a life giver. It's used in Ezekiel 37. It's used in creation and on and on. And when it's not used for just wind, it usually has a theological meaning. There is no breath in them. There is no spirit in them. God's not in them. Okay? They are worthless, the work of mockery. In time of their punishment, they will perish. The portion of Jacob is not like these. Now, the portion of Jacob. God, in Psalm 73:26, God's portion, we are God's portion, and God is our portion. It's like an inheritance. And that's what it's talking about here. The portion of Jacob is that God belongs to Israel uniquely. That's what it's trying to say. Israel's the firstborn among all the nations in relation to God. He is the maker of all, is He. And Israel is the tribe of His inheritance. Now, King James has the rod. Now, rod is the etymology of that word. It means a standard. God is the standard by which everything is judged. So whether it should be tribe or rod, both are very possible linguistically. And I don't know which it is. The Lord of hosts is His name. Now, since we're in a context of astral worship, it's very possible that Jeremiah is not just saying that God is the captain of the angels of heaven. He may be saying God is the controller of the heavenly bodies. The host of heaven belong to God. He put them there. He controls them. They're not powers in and of themselves controlling men's lives. They're just stars and planets and blobs of dead rock that twinkle. Notice now 17, we're going to change gears. We're through with idolatry now. Wasn't that a poignant, ironical, sarcastic treatment of the vanity of man worshiping what he makes with his hands, whether it be a wooden idol put on a stump, or whether it be a skyscraper, or whether it be a modern computer, or whether it be an IBM missile? Man worshiping thing that he's made is ridiculous. 17 and following deals with the exile. It's apparently right at the door. Pick up your bundles from the ground. The word pick up is an imperative. It's a command. Your bundles from the ground means all you can have is what you can carry. Can you imagine what exile would be? If you went in your house tonight and someone said, you're leaving tomorrow, and all you can take with you is what you can carry, what would you do? You wouldn't take your stereo and your color TV. You wouldn't take your bathtub nor your commode. What would you take? My silverware. Yuck. You know, what do you take if you got to carry everything? These have lost everything. Was gone. Everything is gone. Look what God says in verse 18. For thus saith the Lord, I am slinging out the inhabitants of the land. God didn't. Babylon was an instrument of God. Matter of fact, the Old Testament says that Syria is the rod of my anger. God allowed this to happen because Israel rejected Him. God did it. God's in control of history. That's the affirmation, these next few verses. Notice in verse 20 and following, He uses the metaphor of a tent. Now, where is that going back to? It's going back to their nomadic life. We often have metaphors that go back to a previous time in our existence that aren't applicable now. Have you ever listened to the words of the Star Spangled Banner? That's talking about a fight in a fort on the eastern United States where they use these little rockets you shoot off. We don't shoot little rockets off anymore. We don't get in forts and fight ships with sails. But we still sing that song, right? That's kind of what's happening here. They're going back to their nomadic days and picking on about their tent existence. They don't live in tents, but that's a part of their culture. Notice where it says, my sons, the ropes are broken. The Bible often uses a tent to describe prosperity when you lengthen the ropes. to describe a fast movement. They took down their tent. Here, when the ropes are broken, the tent falls. My sons have gone from me and are no more. There is no one to stretch out my tent again or to set up my curtains. This is saying my children are dead. Now, to a Jew, when your sons die, boy, that was almost like saying the worst that could happen is when your children die. No one to help them set up their tent. In other words, they couldn't put it back. Humpty Dumpty is broke, and nobody can put Humpty Dumpty back together. That's what he's talking about. Verse 21, the shepherds have become stupid. Well, who are the shepherds? They're the preachers and the prophets and the civil leaders and the king and the wise men. They are the leaders of the nation, the prophets and the priests and the civil leaders. They're the shepherds. That metaphor is used all over in the Bible. It comes from Ezekiel chapter 34, where it's extended longer. God is shepherd is the key. He gives people in charge, right? They become under shepherds, and that's what it's saying here. The shepherds are stupid. Tactful. They have not sought the Lord, therefore they have not prospered, and their flock is scattered. Now the sound of the report, behold, it comes, a great commotion. The word there is earthquake, great earthquake out of the land of the north. Why the north? That is the only possible geographical trek for armies to attack Palestine. They did not have the vehicles to cross the desert without water. So the only way for anybody, anywhere but from the south, to come into Israel, they got to come over the Fertile Crescent and down along the coast. That's the only way it's possible to come. Nobody else, no army has ever come any other way. So talking about the north is, we think it's Babylon. That fits best historically. But it's talking about any invader that it had to come that way. And notice what's happened. To make the cities of Judah a desolation, a haunt of jackals. That's another metaphor we've used. Archaeology has pretty well confirmed this, that after Nebuchadnezzar came through Judah, the cities were not rebuilt. They may have been partially inhabited for a brief period, but nothing consistently re-inhabited until Ezra, Nehemiah. Okay, verse 23 and following. I know, O Lord, that a man's way is not in himself. Now, the word for man in that verse is the word Adam. But when we say it in Hebrew, it's Adam. It means red clay. Okay, there's that one word for man. The second verse, nor is it in a man who walks to direct his step. That's the word for man-ish. That's the two Hebrew words for man there. I think it is a sign that we're speaking about mankind. And what it's saying is, man does not direct his own paths. What is that saying? That is an affirmation of the sovereignty of God over history, over nations, over individuals, over families. Nothing just happens. God is in control of his world, is what it's trying to say. And the metaphor they use is, man's way is not in himself, nor is it a man who walks to direct his steps. God does. Now, verse 24. Correct me, O Lord, but with justice, not with thine anger, lest thou bring me to nothing. Okay? You might want to see Proverbs 3:12 there. I think that's very important. And then verse 25. Pour out thy wrath on the nations that do not know thee. Jeremiah is saying, look, we have played the fool, but we're still your people. If you really want to get mad at Babylon. Have mercy on us and blast them. That'd be a good paraphrase. Okay, questions or comments about Jeremiah 10? I hope slowly but surely what I'm doing is try to put together for you an Old Testament theology, a way of looking at the Bible through the eyes of a Jew, the way of seeing history, not just from the New Testament, but from where it began in the Old Testament. And all these little words and phrases and comments about how a Jew looked at things is trying to do that for you. It'll take a while, a lot of books, a lot of nights, but slowly but surely you ought to be able, when you really want to start thinking in an Old Testament mode. And that'll help you understand the New Testament tremendously. Remember, Jews wrote the Bible. Jesus was a Jew, remember? He was an Anglo-Saxon, yes. Yeah, it was the official language of Persia. And, of course, Persia is not on the scene yet. But the area that came Persia, I think it's called Aram, how do you pronounce that? That was the language there. And only later did it become the official lingua franca of the world. So no, it's not official yet, but it is something that's possibly written. You know, he was familiar with it, I guess. Isn't that strange? If you knew, it's like Terry, like you in the middle of writing something, just changing the Spanish, one little thought and then going back to English. People would say, huh. I don't know. Yes, Donna? No. That's what so was an affirmation. You know, presuppositionally, we believe that the Bible we have in our hands is what God wants us to have. Looking at it historically scares you to death, the political intrigues and all that happened to get it to us. But the Dead Sea Scrolls verified that the 800-year after Christ manuscripts we had were very, very accurate. No. No, sure wasn't. The only thing that those scrolls also did, one reason King James needs to be revised, maybe King James 2 does it. I'm not sure. I haven't seen the King James 2. A lot of things in the Old Testament, we used to make them ostriches or all kinds of animals would stick in strange passages. And what we learn now is those are the names of foreign gods.